In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Welcome. Thank you for joining me here on the iSpy Radio Show, helping you get a little more intelligence on big government. You know, the basic concept of government spending is not difficult. Don't spend more money than you take in, just like your budget at home. But where it gets fuzzy is how the government accounts for both spending and revenue. Nowhere is this more true than in PERS, the Retirement Fund for Public Employees. The government puts money into an account, that money is invested, and they assume they will get a certain percentage back. This is the assumed earnings rate. A safe bet is usually 3 to 5%. And this is where they get into trouble. If the state is not putting enough money in because they're spending willy-nilly on other things, or because the amount of money they're spending looks bad, they just change the numbers, the assumed earnings rate. This makes it look like they're earning more money than they really are. Instead of 4%, they say, oh, we bet we'll make 6% instead. In Oregon, they've used 7.5%. Oregon is tens of billions in the hole right now. To make this up, Oregon will have to raise taxes massively, or they could cut spending. But Democrats don't like cutting spending any more than they like cutting trees. But wait, it gets worse, because here in Oregon, the Democrat governor, the Democrat House, and the Democrat Senate all signed into a bill that will punish small businesses, and only small businesses. And then there's the internet sales tax that could cripple small businesses. And did you know that Oregon's own attorney general is pushing for that sales tax? There is a storm of epic proportions, and it's all headed your way here on today's iSpy Radio Show. I'd like to welcome Jonathan Williams. He is the Vice President of the Center for State Fiscal Reform at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Jonathan, it's always great to talk to you.
Well, thanks for having me back, and greetings from the land of make-believe, Washington, D.C. here, and it gets that way more all the time.
Yeah, boy, that's for sure. And, you know, as we were putting together this show, I have to say my producer probably said it best. It was a tough one to put together because just doing the research on what was going on here in Oregon was so terribly depressing. When it comes to our financial house, and I know that you have some news there for us and on your upcoming Rich States, Poor States. But let's start by talking about the omnibus budget. I think it sums up a lot of what we want to talk about. Trump got these great tax cuts through over the objections of his own party, I might add. We saw companies begin increasing wages, giving bonuses, repatriating money from overseas. People were keeping more of their own money, as were companies, which meant that they could then hire more people, so unemployment dropped and on. All the right things. Trump's also done amazingly well on trade. Things are moving along nicely there. And then comes along this bloated omnibus spending bill, $1.3 trillion. Given his success, you would think that Republicans would have learned from it. I mean, did this huge bloated spending bill surprise you?
It did. It was unfortunate, and I think it's a really raw deal, obviously, for taxpayers. I think there's some hope that given that Congress and the president have rescission authority where they can deappropriate, if you will, some of that and realize that it was a mistake and it was overspending and realize that, unfortunately, I think politics got the best out of that decision-making process. And it's like what I like to call an election year budget, which Oregon, of course, has had a few of those over the years that just completely bloat spending. Everyone wants to go and brag on the new thing that they brought home to their district. And we have way too many of those included in the omnibus package and a lot of pork, and hopefully Republican leaders and Congress at large and the president come back and do the right thing and use their rescission authority and trim some of that fat out of the budget to give taxpayers something that does not set us up for a tax increase going forward and reverse a lot of those good things that you were talking about that came out of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act late last year.
Well, when I saw that come out, it reminded me a little bit about what happened there in Kansas, and we'll talk about that maybe in the next segment there. But, you know, now that Ryan has announced his retirement, do you foresee a change in how these budget bills are put together, and who do you think might replace him?
Good question. I mean, the scuttlebutt around Washington this week is, of course, Kevin McCarthy is his number two. His majority leader would move up at some point when the speaker is gone. It sounds like the speaker plans to serve out the remainder of his term. So it'd be something that perhaps would be talked about after the election, although there's some in Congress that would like to have that discussion earlier. But then again, there's Steve Scalise from Louisiana as well, who's been mentioned as a potential successor. And both of them would have different angles of probably how they would take the leadership position. Part of me remains a bit skeptical that if kind of the budget wonk himself, Paul Ryan, the Ryan budget, of course, what he put together every year when he was budget committee chairman, didn't really fundamentally, because of the institutional problems that we have in Washington, the ingrained bias towards higher spending and higher taxes that we have had in Congress since the Budget Control Act of the 1970s put in place, that it's going to be very tough sledding for whomever the new speaker is, unless some of those rules are revisited.
Well, that's for sure. And I was very disappointed with Ryan because, as you say, he used to be a budget hawk. And it seems like whenever he got, since taking over the speakership, suddenly that fiscal responsibility has flown out the window. And this $1.3 trillion bill, I think, is a good example of that. Are you concerned that we might see a Democrat take over the House?
Well, I'll tell you what, and of course, we are a nonpartisan organization, so we just kind of follow it from the sidelines on the political side. But I do think that there's a real chance that we will see a change of power in Washington. The average of the seats that the party out of power gains in a first president's midterm of the presidential cycle like this puts them very close to having a majority for the Democrats. And whether that would be Speaker Pelosi again or it would be some fresh new face on the other side, we do not know at this point. But I do think that there's many in this town bracing for the possibility that it could be a Democrat-run U.S. House. And, of course, the Senate is 51 Republican votes right now. And so just looking on the sidelines, that is stranger things have happened. We saw what happened in Alabama with that special election and others. And so President Trump could be looking at a scenario where one or both houses of Congress will be run by Democrats as we go into 2019.
It's a scary thought, but if that happens, I think Republicans just have themselves to blame on this. And this omnibus bill, I think, would be a big part of it. We only got about a minute here with you. Let's talk tariffs real quickly. Free market principle people are generally against tariffs. But when you have a situation where the other side has punitive tariffs, to me, that's not unfair to put in your own tariffs to balance things out. I mean, it's not free trade if only one side is committed to fairness. China has suddenly backed down. What are your thoughts on tariffs and unfair trading partners?
Well, you know, and this is one of those things where I'm a free trade guy. I know you and I have chatted about this many times, and I think that we have to worry about tariffs in the sense that tariffs are taxes, right? And they're going to be borne by consumers at some level. Now, the question is, on the other side of it, is the fairness question. And the other part of this is, we all know that the president is famous for the art of the deal, right? I mean, that's kind of how he made his stamp on his fame nationally. And how much of these trade discussions are really that art of the deal being played out, and will it bring China to the table? And I think that's a broader, more fundamental question when it comes to addressing some of the fairness issues, the theft of intellectual property, some of those things that have been alleged have happened to see if maybe those things can be addressed. And obviously, though, we do have to keep an eye on tariffs or taxes, and that's something that we don't want to claw back from benefits of federal tax reform at the same time.
No. Well, it is looking like China has blinked on this, so let's hope that that remains true. Coming up, the left's boogeyman of why tax cuts are evil.
I'm Sam Carpenter, and I'm running for governor of Oregon because I've watched our magnificent state suffer through three decades of failed progressive far-left leadership. Businesses are choked by high taxes and too many regulations. Our schools are failing, and our forests are burning. The streets of Portland are no longer charming, they're scary. And our government is out of control with reckless spending on failed social experiments instead of serving the people. It's high time to give a voice to the forgotten families of Oregon who want their children to get a great education. It's high time to bring common sense back to the management of our natural resources. And it's high time to create powerful economic opportunity in every corner of Oregon. As your governor, I'll lift the jackboot of too much government, and I'll give power back to the everyday people who live here. I'm Sam Carpenter, and I approve this message. Join me, and let's make Oregon great again. Paid for by friends of Sam Carpenter.
And welcome back. We're talking to Jonathan Williams today. He is with ALEC. That's the American Legislative Exchange Council. You can find their website at alec.org, and we'll link that up on ispyradio.com as well. Jonathan, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about Kansas. This is the boogeyman for the left to try to scare lawmakers away from making any tax cuts. And you know, it just reminds me so much, actually, of what we saw with this omnibus bill, where we got these tax cuts. And then just the very next thing that you know, here's the Fed's raising spending, $1.3 trillion. It's like somebody gets a pay raise of $1,000 a month. So they go out there and instead increase their spending by $2,000 a month. And it just seems that's the way with these lawmakers. But let's talk a little bit about what happened with Kansas, because, like I said, they really have become the boogeyman for why you shouldn't have any kind of tax cuts.
Well, this is a simple concept. As Art Laffer likes to say, it's not rocket surgery. This is basic economics. You have to balance your spending with your taxes. They're two sides of the same fiscal coin. And at the state level, especially, when 49 states have balanced budget requirements, they need to balance taxes and spending. The feds can fudge it a little bit more and put off the pain longer by running deficits, although we know those bills come due, and then, of course, using quantitative easing and running the printing presses 24 hours a day to make sure that they're okay and are not running out of money. So clearly that's bad policy, but the feds don't need to make the decisions quite as quickly to balance the books like the states do, where when Kansas got into trouble, they spent like drunken sailors coming out of cutting taxes, and they got themselves into some really serious budget shortfalls, and they would not control spending. You're right. There are some parallels. I do think that the federal government, we have more time to correct those mistakes, where Kansas, once those mistakes were made, it was going to be very difficult to pare that back without some real rethinking of how they wanted to go about spending. But the one thing that people forget about the Kansas experiment is it was done by Republicans. This is not a bipartisan bash against Democrats. There was a lot of big spending Republicans, though, that got elected by the unions, the teachers unions specifically, that came in with that in mind, is to repeal the tax cuts and to grow government spending. Kansas has been a red state nationally for a long time, but has not been a conservative state. In fact, Sam Brownback was probably the first conservative governor in 50 years to be elected in Kansas, and the left wanted to see him fail at all costs. And now, of course, once they had that spending problem, now the left desperately wants to use that narrative to scare other tax cutters away from tax cuts and try to bend the narrative to put forward so many myths about the Kansas scenario that are just not based whatsoever in fact.
What are some of those myths that they put out there?
Well, one of the big ones is that Kansas economy fell down after tax cutting. The reality is Kansas has been lagging the nation for 50 years in economic growth. And working with some of the sponsors of the bill to cut taxes originally at ALEC, we talked with them, and you know, as they were talking about some of the broad ideas, and the rationale for cutting taxes was to make Kansas more competitive. So while Kansas still lagged the national averages after cutting taxes, they lagged the national average less than before the experiment. So it showed for a period of time tax cuts did work. Then, of course, Kansas regressed back to the mean and raised taxes twice, two of the largest tax increases in state history. So it's very hard to analyze what ended up happening in Kansas and blaming it all on tax cuts, because it was clearly many, many other factors at play. The other thing, one of the big myths that the left likes to use about Kansas is supposedly public education spending was decimated because of tax cuts. But when you look at the actual numbers of year-over-year spending growth, spending on K-12 education actually rose each and every year throughout the Brownback administration, and now sits at setting all-time K-12 spending records.
Wow.
That is after the tax cuts. So much for decimating public education.
Yeah, really. Well, you actually have a great video up on ALEC. It was actually through Heritage, and we'll make sure that we link that up on ispyradio.com, because you guys do a great job of walking us through what had happened And it's just really three simple mistakes there when it comes right down to it, is that number one, you don't cut taxes and then increase spending. You have a plan to balance the budget and you have the right systems in place. And I think really that's the big thing that worries me about this omnibus bill, is they cut the taxes and then they increase the spending.
Well, it takes political courage. It's easy to cut taxes because it's good for taxpayers and it's good politics many times. But the difficult side of that equation is how do you make Yes. the necessary spending reductions or controlling state spending going forward to pay for that? And that's really where the rubber hits the road.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. In terms of where are they now with the whole Kansas thing? Have they started to correct that? Have they backed off on spending at all?
No, they have not. In fact, after one of the largest tax increases in state history in 2015, and then the largest tax increase in Kansas state history again in 2017, they have continued to put the pedal to the metal on spending. And now, even after these huge tax increases, they're facing deficits in just a couple of short years. Also, they have a state Supreme Court who has basically usurped the authority of the legislature and continues to say you need to spend more and more on K-12 education. And so they're in a very difficult situation. Taxes continue to go up on income taxes and sales taxes, and on even discriminatory taxes on things like vaping have been instituted to pay for their spending habits. And guess what? They're still facing red ink even after all of these big tax increases. So if that doesn't tell you a story of what the problem is it's the spending side, no doubt about it.
Yeah, the spending will always get you in trouble, for sure. And also, just one of the other factoids there that I thought was really fascinating to see how that all unfolded is actually when Brownback was looking for tax cuts, he only wanted a package of about $500 million in tax cuts. But by the time it came out of the legislature, suddenly they jimmied it up to $3 billion in tax cuts. That's got to be a lot for a state like Kansas.
Well, it is. And the interesting story there is the people who really upped the bill on the tax cuts were not people who actually wanted to cut taxes. They were people trying to stop the tax cut and make it too expensive. In fact, they took away all the needed pay-fors and the base broadenings of the tax reform that would have made it feasible to go forward, and did this purposely to dare Governor Brownback to veto it. And then when he signed it, it became so unaffordable that it would fall apart under its own weight if there was no spending control. And guess what? They weren't getting into line asking to help control spending to make it work either. Yeah, they wanted to fail from the start.
Well, and that's, you know, I just kind of think that's what happened with that omnibus bill. But who's to blame? I can't tell if it's the Democrats or just the Republicans in his own party that wanted to see Trump fail. So let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we're going to continue our discussion here with Jonathan Williams of ALEC. That's the American Legislative Exchange Council. When we come back, we're going to be talking about internet sales tax and how that's going to bury small businesses.
I'm Sam Carpenter, and I'm running for governor of Oregon because I've watched our magnificent state suffer through three decades of failed progressive far-left leadership. Businesses are choked by high taxes and too many regulations. Our schools are failing, and our forests are burning. The streets of Portland are no longer charming. They're scary. And our government is out of control with reckless spending on failed social experiments instead of serving the people. It's high time to give a voice to the forgotten families of Oregon who want their children to get a great education. It's high time to bring common sense back to the management of our natural resources. And it's high time to create powerful economic opportunity in every corner of Oregon. As your governor, I'll lift the jackboot of too much government, and I'll give power back to the everyday people who live here. I'm Sam Carpenter, and I approve this message. Join me, and let's make Oregon great again.
Paid for by friends of Sam Carpenter.
And we're back. Talk today to Jonathan Williams. He's the Vice President of the Center for State Fiscal Reform at the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, A-L-E-C. Jonathan, you know, more and more people are doing their shopping online. This means that people are doing less shopping at brick-and-mortar stores in their own cities and neighborhoods. And, of course, that means that states that have sales taxes are losing revenue, which means then that those states are looking at ways to replace that sales tax dollars by taxing online those online sales. So is this a matter of replacing actual lost tax dollars, or is it a matter of states looking at billions of dollars of online sales revenue and seeing that as a big juicy revenue stream that they ought to be tapping into?
Well, I think it's more of the latter, that states are looking out there to see what else is out there that they can tax and looking at ways to find more revenue and look for ways to spend more money generally. Yeah. And that has been driving this discussion for many years as to how to tax those online transactions or catalog transactions in the past that have been going tax-free in terms of people not directly paying it when they make the purchases, because the rule is, and this goes back to the Quill decision from the U.S. Supreme Court in 1992, of physical presence. If a retailer has a physical presence, a building, or has a payroll in a state, then it needs to collect and remit the sales taxes made to customers in that state. But if it does have no physical presence and no footprint in a state, then it's up to those individual customers to pay the use tax on their purchases that they make online. And it's not up to the business, because why? The Supreme Court in 92 said there's 6,000 taxing jurisdictions, not just the 45 states that have sales taxes, but 6,000 taxing jurisdictions at that time across the United States. And it's an undue burden on interstate commerce, which, of course, is a in the United States Constitution to be protected because of our lessons, the failed Articles of Confederation, where state and local governments, colonies at the time, of course, became fiefdoms basically and just tried to tax trade. So we wanted to create this 50-state trade free trade zone, which we did, and it was allowed to commerce was allowed to grow unfettered, where states can't put up barriers to stop Utah can't put up a border and say that trade can't go through on its way to California from New York, and they can't have discriminatory taxes on interstate commerce. And the court ruled in 92, I think correctly, that the burden of collection and remittance and having to deal with 6,000 taxing jurisdictions at the time was too great a burden, and said it was unconstitutional at that point unless Congress came in and simplified. Well, guess what? Fast forward to today, we don't have 6,000 taxing jurisdictions. We have 12,000 taxing jurisdictions around the United States, and the court this year is going to be hearing South Dakota versus Wayfair is the name of the case, where South Dakota is trying to tax these online transactions for companies like Overstock.com and Wayfair and Newegg, companies that have no physical presence or connection to South Dakota other than customers, are now being forced to collect and remit sales taxes to South Dakota. They sued, said it's unconstitutional. South Dakota Supreme Court agreed with the retailers, but then on appeal, it is now before the United States Supreme Court. They'll be hearing oral arguments on tax day, ironically, and then we'll have a decision by the end of their term in June.
You know, whenever I hear these discussions, I'm reminded of what New York State did, where this was probably a dozen years or more ago. And they were at that time losing out on sales tax revenues because, you know, New York State is punitive when it comes to sales tax. And so what they started doing was they put a line on their tax forms for people to voluntarily add what they should have paid in sales tax for their online purchases had they bought them at a store in New York. But they then went further and threatened them that if they didn't think that you were put in a high enough amount, they were going to rifle through your credit card transactions. And it's just astonishing to think that a government thinks that is somehow proper to do.
I mean, huge privacy concerns when it comes to this, right, and many other. But that just is a great example, and there's so many great examples of how aggressive states have become at trying to tax these online transactions or tax out-of-state businesses even better to be their unpaid tax collectors and collecting their taxes for them. And New York is a perfect example. Their tax department is so aggressive that you may have seen the news stories. It started with the jock tax on athletes that came into the Yankee Stadium for a few days of the year and trying to attribute their portion of their annual income that happened in New York based on those few days. They were going after them for that. They got to a point where they're going after business travelers going through Kennedy Airport, connecting and perhaps going overseas to say, if we can prove that you sent work emails while you're sitting at your connection at the lounge at Kennedy Airport, we're going to say that you owe one day your total income that year to New York State. Now imagine that, the tax department going after people selling on eBay and Etsy and trying to make a go of it by expanding their businesses, small businesses online. New York calls up and says, you owe New York taxes, and if you don't pay, we're going to drag you before New York tax court. That is a real and present danger, I think, for small businesses. There's a chance that many e-commerce providers will be shut down if the Supreme Court strikes down these physical presence requirements. And, of course, for no sales tax states like Oregon, this is a huge danger.
Sure. Well, what would it actually mean? I mean, if that goes through, I mean, would that mean that Oregonians who don't have a sales tax will have to pay sales tax to states that they don't even live in?
Well, so what it would mean, it would be mostly for the small businesses in Oregon who, let's say a small business who is just solely based in Oregon for the purposes of this example, have never collected a sales tax dollar in their history of their business, right? Unless I guess you've got a small sales tax on new car sales now or whatnot. But let's talk about, let's say, an Etsy seller or somebody selling something small on eBay, selling in state. You, of course, have no sales tax or nothing to apply with. But if you're selling out of state right now, you do not have to collect and remit sales taxes to those 45 states that have sales taxes or the 12,000 taxing jurisdictions because you have no physical presence there. If the court strikes down the physical presence standard, what states could do is claim that regardless of where you're located, they're going to send you a requirement to start collecting and remitting sales taxes for wow. all those states and localities if you're an Oregon-based business. You've never had to do that. Now you do. The average cost of compliance with that kind of national regime, where of course you can't choose where your customers come from, so it could be multiple states and multiple localities, could be something that's high enough that puts Oregon small businesses completely out of business.
Wow. That is just awful. Speaking of small businesses, Oregon's Democrat Governor Kate Brown just signed a bill to punish small businesses and only small businesses as a favor to her union donors. That's up next. Also, thanks to Kate Brown, Oregon is now a sanctuary state for illegal immigrants. You can help put it on the ballot so voters can decide. Head to StopOregonSanctuaries.org. Print, sign, mail. It's that easy. Do it today. That's StopOregonSanctuaries.org. And welcome back. We're talking to David Jonathan Williams. He is the Vice President of the Center for State Fiscal Reform at the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, A-L-E-C. Their website is alec.org, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. So, Jonathan, we were talking during the break there about not only this internet sales tax, but some really shocking developments. First of all, that Governor Kate, the Democrat there in office, is kind of mum on this whole topic.
Well, yeah, Governor Brown, I've seen her say absolutely nothing about this existential threat to Oregon small business that is before the U.S. Supreme Court, which I find very surprising. And you know, we've seen even Democrat, Republican members of Congress, governors from the other no sales tax states. In fact, former Chairman Ron Wyden of Oregon has said pretty vocally that he opposes the internet tax. We've had Senator Tester from Montana. Mark, we even have California Democrats saying this is bad for e-commerce and technology to have this kind of a physical presence standard go away. And yet we have silence, it seems, from Governor Brown. And your attorney general has actually signed a brief of the states to ask for the court to review and overturn the physical presence standard under Quill. So you, Oregon, is on record because of your attorney general asking for the court to overturn the physical presence standard, which is something that is essential for Oregon. Essential. And that is just remarkable to me.
Well, you know, Oregon is pretty proud of the fact that we don't have sales tax. Generally speaking, you even raise the shadow of a sales tax and people will vote it down, unless they don't call it a sales tax, which is what happened with the whole healthcare tax. But it is rather surprising that our own attorney general is in favor of this tax. I mean, that's just astonishing. This is really news to us, actually. I haven't seen that anywhere.
I just wonder how many taxpayers around the great state of Oregon know that their attorney general is trying to speak for them to say this standard should be overturned, something that would be absolutely to the detriment of Oregon and the no sales tax states.
Absolutely. So in terms of Kate Brown here, because she has decided to take away a special tax break in Trump's tax plan that specifically was designed to benefit small businesses. Just read a little bit here from the Willamette Week articles. SB 1528 disconnects Oregon from part of the federal tax code. The sweeping tax bill Congress passed allows certain small businesses, so-called pass-through entities, including S-Corps, limited liability companies, and partnerships, to deduct 20% of qualified business income. But those in Oregon now will not get it. I mean, is this sort of thing happening elsewhere in other states that they're trying to punish small businesses by taking away that new tax break?
This, I will say, following how the states have reacted, it is generally by enhancing tax cuts at the state level because this unexpected revenue is coming in due to the change in the federal code. Oregon is one of very, very few exceptions that I could say that now that we have about 30 states that have reported how they feel the Trump tax plan will affect their budget this year. Oregon is unique in that it is looking ways to actually decouple and raise revenue. Most states are trying to actually figure out ways to give more money back because they have all this windfall of unexpected revenue coming into the state budget. That's something we saw after the Reagan tax reform of 1986, very consistent to what we're seeing. Almost all states are seeing a windfall of unexpected revenue. So that's what it puts Oregon so far out into left field, asking to keep more of this money in government coffers' hands instead of the hands of job creators.
I just don't get what Governor Kate Brown is doing on this because, as you say, this is going to punish small businesses. You've got the business owners that this will impact. It also impacts all of their employees as well. I mean, you're talking between, estimates that I've seen are between 300 to 600,000 people that are going to be impacted by Oregon taking away this tax break that we had just gotten.
Well, and that's exactly right. And we all know that the small business portion of it is probably the most important for job creation and innovation. That's why the president and Congress came through and really did focus quite a bit of the efforts on the business side of the tax relief. And to take that tip of the spear of something that is some of the most influential policy change for future job creation in state and then take it away where all the other states are really going forward and doubling down and even having additional tax cuts passed at the state level this year. This is just moving Oregon completely in the wrong direction. And of course, as a state that's been in the bottom 10 in our competitiveness rankings in rich states, poor states for many years, I can only imagine what this will do to future rankings as other states are trying to move the ball forward.
Well, it's like the example that I know that we have talked about before is, the states are 50 test tubes of not only democracy, but also of economic policies. And so you've got these two states, one on either side of the street. You've got Oregon over here and Washington over there. And one has a sign that says big sale. Everything's now 50% off versus the one across the street that says and now everything 50% more expensive. Which store are you going to go into?
Yeah, come on in and shop with us. We'll give you higher prices. It doesn't work that way, right?
Taxes
are a direct price of doing business and working and investing in a state versus another. And I mean, that's the beauty of the laboratories of democracy and innovation idea. And we know exactly what works as the states that value lower taxes. And then regionally speaking, of course, Utah has been number one in our index for all 10 years. And Idaho just did some very, very good things because of federal tax reform. We'll talk more about that when the new rankings come out, but they're going to be one of the biggest winners of 2018's index.
Well, it just really is shocking how Oregon is punishing small businesses for daring to do business here. Let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we're going to be talking about the PERS situation. This is not just happening here in Oregon, but all across the nation, how these public employee pensions are just destroying budgets. Stay with us.
Law enforcement officials across the country, even in California, are rejecting sanctuary laws that shield criminal aliens. In Oregon, the Stop Oregon Sanctuaries campaign is working to repeal the statute that makes Oregon a de facto sanctuary state. Your signature will help us get initiative petition number 22 on the 2018 ballot. Go to StopOregonSanctuaries.org and print your own petition. Then simply sign, date, and mail. It's that easy. Go to StopOregonSanctuaries.org. Do it today.
And welcome back. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams of ALEC. That's the American Legislative Exchange Council. We're talking about the dire situation that Oregon is finding itself in. And it seems like if there's one gigantic quagmire that just seems to pop up every single year, it has to do with PERS, the Public Employee Retirement System. This is not a situation that is unique to Oregon. Public employee payouts are killing states with these unfunded liabilities, meaning how much we had promised versus how much we have in the bank to cover it. It's kind of interesting, though, is because when you start looking at some of these estimates in terms of our shortfalls, it seems like you can never get a consistent number. And they're always all over the place. So I've seen estimates here within Oregon of $25 billion, $50 billion, $100 billion. I even saw one that said $200 billion. It's not just Oregon. They're saying some Harvard researchers put together some numbers and said the gap is anywhere between $757 billion and $4.4 trillion. I mean, why are there such wide ranges in the estimates of how big these deficits are?
Well, that's a good question, and they're big deficits when it comes to the unfunded liabilities in pension plans. And, our ALEC report, Unaffordable and Unaccountable, that we put out every year shows Oregon's just north of $100 billion, about $109 billion. But the real answer to that question is it's how you assume what you're going to earn in these plans over the next 30 years, because we know that these are long-term benefits. You know, politicians like to get the short-term benefits out of promising things and retroactively adding new benefits and many things that are great politics, but then, of course, they're masters at kicking the can down the road. We know they know that they're 30-year benefits before the bills come due in many cases, and they'll be long out of office, and their successors will have to be there to take care of it and pick up the pieces. And that's one of the political incentives that have driven this crisis over the last several decades. And it's really all, though, about, you know, some states still assume, the average state, for instance, assumes they're going to earn something like 7.5% every single year for the next 30 years. And mind you, these are risk-free defined benefit plans, as you discussed, talking about these benefits are going to be paid regardless of what happens in the marketplace. And then versus our report, where we assume a much more prudent, conservative assumed rates of return that should be matched, in our view, to the risk level of the liability, which is it is a guaranteed payout for public employees. So therefore, we ought to be using something much more conservative to use for the estimates of unfunded liabilities. That's why you see the wide difference in all these estimates.
Well, the problem with those wide-ranging deficits is it seems to me that lawmakers aren't getting good information to then make good decisions. I mean, if you don't have an accurate picture of how big the problem is, you're not going to come up with solutions big enough to fix those problems. It's like a ship. You know, if it's got a small leak, you could maybe apply some tape or a little something. If it's a giant iceberg strike, I mean, you need to get it into dry dock for some drastic overhaul.
Well, that's right. And, you know, the one other thing, though, to remember is regardless of how you go about looking at the liabilities and what estimates you use, whether it's something like risk-free like ours, like a 2.5% assumed rate of return, whether you what the bond rating agencies say is about 4.5%, which is the average in the private sector defined benefit plans, or if you go really generous and perhaps risky and go to what the states assume, regardless of what you use, these are big numbers, they're growing, and they're a huge threat to taxpayers.
Yes.
And, by the way, consumers of government services, which this cost, the pension cost, grows every single year in the budget, and it's going to continue to grow because it's on autopilot and is protected by Constitution or property right in many cases, where it will not be altered, the accrued benefits, and therefore people are going to lose other spending that they like, or they're going to see taxes radically go up. That's why this is a bipartisan problem, and that's something for the left and the right to be concerned about.
Oh, absolutely. But unfortunately, Democrat Governor Kate Brown is just trying to ignore it. In fact, she's been very clear that she doesn't want to touch these benefits because she's up for re-election this year. And she knows that doing so would be very unpopular, although apparently she's perfectly okay to punish 300-some thousand small businesses. But she doesn't want to either sell state lands nor open to them to the logging because that would tick off environmentalists. So we've essentially got a politician who doesn't want to attack the problem because of her own self-interest. The other thing that they had suggested was potentially privatizing states' public universities and also selling off some other state assets, although there was a pretty good line out there that they called it the governor's pawn shop.
Well, you know, probably what needs to happen, obviously, is looking at for new hires, moving to more of a 401k style approach, like so many other states have done in recent years, to start bending the cost curve on pensions. But, you know, getting back to what you said on the governor's political incentives, that's exactly the problem that states are finding themselves in. It's so hard to reform public pensions because nobody wants to do it during an election year because the political incentives are misaligned with what's right to do on the policy basis.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we had some fixes a few years ago where it was this bipartisan effort to fix PERS. And unfortunately, Oregon's state Supreme Court threw that out the window. So we're right back to where we were. So what are some blueprints that we have from other states that are making it work? Or is this just not being taken care of in other states?
Well, for the vast majority of states, it's not being taken care of well, but there is a bit of light at the end of the tunnel on this and a bit of good news, even though it is a lot of doom and gloom on the pension liabilities front, because what we hear in Illinois and Chicago and Detroit bankruptcy and the California cities and a lot of very bad things and drivers of Puerto Rico debt and things like that, a lot of bad news. But my home state of Michigan moved to much more of a 401k private sector model last last year for its teachers plan after John Engler did in the 90s for the state employees. We've seen Utah move in the right direction in 2011. We've seen Oklahoma move in the right direction. Even Blue Rhode Island temporarily moved in the right direction. And then last year, we saw Pennsylvania enact a hybrid 401k-style pension reform that was signed by a Democrat governor, a liberal Democrat, signing into law to say this is something that needs to happen. And so we are beginning to see a breakthrough, even in states that are not unanimously controlled by conservatives. I mean, we're looking at very purplish or blue states, and we're seeing even Democrat chief executives sign pension reform into law because they know that this is a huge problem for their state budget, for the state finances in general going forward.
Oh, absolutely. And I know here in Oregon, the latest estimates are is that it's going to cost us at least another $1 billion over the next 2 years. Everyone stay with us. We will wrap things up with Jonathan Williams, and we promise you there will be some good news. Back to talk today to Jonathan Williams of ALEC, that's American Legislative Exchange Council, and I'd like to actually end this show that has been really depressing on a number of levels, at least end on a good note. But before we get there, why don't you talk to us briefly about where Oregon is looking to go in your rich states, poor states rankings?
Sure. Well, so this will be the 11th edition of our Rich States, Poor States rankings. And in previous years, Oregon has many times been in the bottom 10 in economic outlook. This year, I would expect to see something similar to that. I would expect to see Oregon probably back in the bottom 10 again, if I had to guess. I only know what I read in the newspaper, Mark, but I think that's safe to say. And certainly based on actions from the governor on the small business tax increase, next year, when those actually would be counted in the rankings, that would look very badly for Oregon's future ranking, given that so many states are moving in the right direction after federal tax reform.
Wow. So let's end on a positive note. Talk to us about a state that's really doing well.
Let me pick out a neighbor of yours. We talk a lot about Utah, of course, with being number one in rich states, poor states for 10 years in a row, but Idaho, mentioned briefly earlier, they're a state that aggressively cut taxes in 2018 as a direct result of federal tax reform, putting more money back into the state, and the state now putting it back into the pockets of individuals and job creators. Great to see probably the biggest tax cuts in a decade or two out of Idaho, a state that otherwise has, I think, underperformed given their conservative bent, have not done enough aggressive things at getting the cost of doing business down. That changed quite a bit in 2018, and I would expect for that state to really grow in terms of its economic competitiveness rankings both this year and hopefully in future years. Very exciting.
Well, in terms of Oregon, what are some things that policymakers should be learning from this? We've got about a minute with you.
I think that, you know, what policymakers ought to continue to see that, you know, there are two very clear models, of course, of what works versus what is not working out there. It's clear that Oregon's been in the California, New York, New Jersey, Illinois model for far too long. But the what people ought to look at is there are a ton of states, not just a couple that we've talked about today, but 30 states have significantly cut taxes in the last 5 years alone in a broad way, in a pro-growth way. And that model is working, and federal tax reform is now opening up a new level of possibilities, I think, for states to do the right thing. States did the right thing after the Reagan tax reform and cut their own taxes. I think we're going to see a record-breaking year in 2018 of states taking that windfall and not using it to grow government, but to use it to put it back in the pockets of hardworking taxpayers and businesses throughout their state. That is the model, I think, that we're going to see work, and we're going to see a continued growth in those states that value free market competition.
Wow. Well, it sounds like pretty much whatever Oregon is doing, we ought to be doing the opposite of it. So, Jonathan, I want to thank you so much for your time today. Always a fascinating discussion.
Thanks for having me back, my friend.
Thank you for joining us today. We certainly hope that you're at least a little wiser for having been here. Don't forget to check iSpyRadio.com for some additional information. Monday, after stations air this show, you can hear the podcast. Even better, share all that with people who need to be warned about what's coming, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.